From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
I have spent the last several days sitting in a crowded, windowless Macy's classroom undergoing the first phases of ELF training. We have been addressed by all sorts of instructors who begin their presentations by saying, "This looks like an outstanding group of elves." Several of the bosses have led us in motivational cheers, a concept which stuns me to the core.
On today's Fresh Air, working as an elf in Macy's Santaland, David Sedaris reads from his Santaland diaries. Also today, unendurable Christmas music, great Christmas music, and a review of Ready to Wear. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United Nations says a Bosnian ceasefire will take effect tomorrow at noon local time. The truce was announced by the UN's representative in the region, Yasushi Akashi. The ceasefire was supposed to take effect today, but had been held up by some unresolved problems. The deal was worked out after 2 days of shuttle diplomacy by Akashi. The original deal was clinched by former President Jimmy Carter earlier this week. Russia says its forces in separatist Chechnya are now blocking Grozny, the capital. Russian forces have also taken over the town of Argun. Only one main road to the south is still open. The BBC's Robert Parsons reports from the Russian-Chechen border.
If, as the Russians claim, Grozny is encircled, the military command must now decide what to do next. So far, Russian casualties appear to have been relatively low. But the Chechens also appear to have been conserving their energies and resources for the defense of Grozny. Russia's tactic has been to sap Chechen morale by subjecting the people of Grozny to persistent and indiscriminate bombardment. Its warplanes have killed scores of people and destroyed hundreds of houses. But the attempts to break the Chechens' resolve appears to be having the opposite effect. If Russia is to complete its operation in Chechnya, it has little choice but to take Grozny by storm. But that's an operation that's likely to take a heavy toll on young Russian lives.
Robert Parsons reporting. Israeli authorities say 2 Israeli soldiers are dead and 7 more were hurt in violence in South Lebanon today. Security sources say Iranian-backed guerrillas fired rocket-propelled grenades and mortar shells at the Israelis and their allied Lebanese militiamen. Israel responded with air raids and artillery fire and say they killed several people. The Arab guerrillas linked to Hezbollah say the attacks are revenge for a car bombing yesterday in Beirut they blame on Israel. That bombing killed 4 people and hurt 25. Officials at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport say an American Airlines jetliner had to make an emergency landing there this morning. No one was seriously hurt. UPI's Jay Saper prepared this report.
The large American Airlines jet screeched onto the runway after reporting hydraulic system problems with its nose landing gear. One passenger who fainted and a pregnant flight attendant went to the hospital. The plane radioed trouble shortly after taking off from San Diego, California, where it lost a deflector shield. A passenger said it felt like they hit a bump and could smell something burning. An airline spokeswoman says the plane was perfectly capable of flying. Jay Saper, Chicago.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen nearly 24 points to 3,838. Trading is active. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq Composite Index is up more than 3 points at 742. This is NPR. Former Secretary of State Dean Rusk has been laid to rest. Rusk died Tuesday in Athens, Georgia. He was 85. Georgia Senator Sam Nunn spoke at his funeral today. He said Rusk brought rare and unique characteristics to his job. Rusk served 2 administrations during the Vietnam War, the Bay of Pigs incident, and the Cuban Missile Crisis. He also taught at the University of Georgia for 25 years. The university's president said Rusk's service to the institution was as outstanding as his service to his country. The Food and Drug Administration says it will allow saline breast implants to stay on the market, but manufacturers must first prove the devices are safe. NPR's Vicky Quay reports.
In 1992, the FDA limited access to silicone-filled breast implants after women reported suffering severe health problems from breaks and leaks. So for many women seeking cosmetic or reconstructive surgery, the only option that left them was saline breast implants, which are silicone shells filled with salt water. But the FDA became concerned the silicone shells of these implants may also pose a risk and began reviewing them. The agency has decided to allow the devices to stay on the market while manufacturers conduct studies on their safety. A final ruling on saline breast implants is expected in 1998. I'm Vicky Quay in Washington.
Democrats in San Francisco are accusing President Clinton of being afraid of congressional conservatives. Their anger is prompted by a report in today's Washington Post that Mr. Clinton won't nominate James Hormel as ambassador to Fiji. The appointment would make the San Francisco philanthropist the first openly gay ambassador to serve the country. San Francisco party members say Mr. Clinton is bypassing Hormel in deference to right-wing powers in Congress. Hormel would have to be confirmed by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, chaired by incoming Republican Jesse Helms. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
My costume is green. I wear green velvet knickers, a forest green velvet smock, and a perky little hat decorated with spangles. This is my work uniform.
Today, Fresh Air does its part to perpetuate what we hope is becoming a Christmas tradition on public radio, the broadcast of David Sedaris's Santaland Diaries. During the Christmas seasons of 1990 and 91, Sedaris worked in the epicenter of New York Christmas shopping as an elf in Macy's Santaland. In 1992, on NPR's Morning Edition, he read excerpts of his journal chronicling his experiences as an elf named Crumpet. Few broadcasts on NPR generated as many calls. Morning Edition rebroadcast the piece last Christmas. We're going to bring you an expanded version. The Santaland Diaries are included in David Sedaris's book Barrel Fever, a collection of essays and stories published earlier this year. Sedaris's NPR commentaries have generated movie and TV offers, but he continues to make a living cleaning houses by day and writing at night. And now Fresh Air presents David Sedaris' Santaland Diaries.
I was in a coffee shop reading the want ads when I saw Macy's Herald Square, the largest store in the world, has big opportunities for outgoing, fun-loving people of all shapes and sizes. Working as an elf in Macy's Santaland means being at the center of the excitement. I brought the ad home, and my roommate Rusty and I were laughing about it, and he dared me to call for an interview. So I did. The woman at Macy's asked, "Would you be interested in full-time elf or evening and weekend elf?" I said, "Full-time elf." I am a 33-year-old man applying for a job as an elf. I often see people on the streets dressed as objects and handing out leaflets. I usually avoid leaflets, but it breaks my heart to see a grown man dressed as a taco. So if there's a costume involved, I tend to not only accept the leaflet, but to accept it graciously, saying, "Thank you so much," and thinking, "You poor son of a bitch." This afternoon on Lexington Avenue, I accepted a leaflet from a man dressed as a camcorder. Hot dogs, tacos, video cameras. These things make me sad because there's no place for them, no community. They don't fit in on the streets. I figured that at least as an elf, I will have a place. I'll be in Santa's village with all the other elves. We live in a fluffy wonderland surrounded by candy canes and gingerbread shacks. It won't be quite as sad as being some big French fry out on a street corner. This afternoon, I sat in the 8th floor Santaland office and was told, "Congratulations, Mr. Sedaris, you're an elf." In order to become an elf, I filled out 10 pages worth of forms, took a multiple-choice personality test, underwent 2 interviews, and submitted urine for a drug test. I failed my drug test. My urine had roaches and stems floating in it, but still they hired me, because I'm short. Everyone they hired is short. I am one of the taller elves. I have spent the last several days sitting in a crowded, windowless Macy's classroom undergoing the first phases of elf training. You can be an entrance elf, a water cooler elf, a bridge elf, train elf, maze elf, island elf, magic window elf, usher elf, cash register elf, or exit elf. We were given a demonstration of various positions in action, acted out by returning elves who were so on stage and goofy that it made me a little sick to my stomach. I don't know that I could look anyone in the eye and exclaim, "Oh my goodness, I think I see Santa!" Or, "Can you close your eyes and make a very special Christmas wish?" Everything these elves say seems to have an exclamation point on the end of it. It makes one's mouth hurt to speak with such forced merriment. It embarrasses me to hear people talk this way. I think I'll be a low-key sort of elf. Today was elf dress rehearsal. Ivy, the woman in charge of costuming, handed out our uniforms and gave us a lecture on keeping things clean. She held up a calendar and said, "Ladies, you know what this is. Use it. I have scraped enough blood out from the crotches of elf knickers to last me the rest of my life. And don't tell me I don't wear underpants. I'm a dancer." "You're not a dancer. If you were a real dancer, you wouldn't be here. You're an elf and you're going to wear panties like an elf." During dress rehearsal, I worked as a Santa elf for house number 2. When you work as a Santa elf, you have to go by your elf name. My elf name is Crumpet. The other elves have names like Jingle and Frosty. They take the children by the hand and squeal with forced delight. They sing and prance and behave like cartoon characters come to life. It frightens me. Today was the official opening day of Santa Land, and I worked as a magic window elf, a Santa elf, and an usher elf. I was at the magic window for 15 minutes before a man approached me and said, "You look so stupid." I have to admit that he had a point, but still. I wanted to say that at least I get paid to look stupid, that he gives it away for free. But I can't say things like that because I'm supposed to be merry. So instead I said, "Thank you. Thank you." As if I had misunderstood and thought he had said, "You look terrific. Thank you." He was a brawny, wise guy, wearing a vinyl jacket and carrying a bag from the Radio Shack. I should have said, real loud, "Sorry, man, I don't date other guys." People would have turned and looked our way, and he would have curled into a little ball and died. ...22,000 people came to see Santa today, and not all of them were well-behaved. Today I witnessed fistfights and vomiting and magnificent tantrums. The back hallway was jammed with people. There was a line for Santa and a line for the women's bathroom. And one woman, after asking me 1,000 questions already, asked, "Which is the line for the women's bathroom?" And I shouted that I thought it was the line with all the women in it. And she said, "I'm going to have you fired." I had 2 people say that to me today. "I'm going to have you fired." Go ahead, be my guest. I'm wearing a green velvet costume. It doesn't get any worse than this. Who do these people think they are? "I'm going to have you fired." And I want to lean over and say, "I'm going to have you killed." This morning I got stuck at the magic window, which is really boring. I'm supposed to stand around and say, "Step on the magic star and you can see Santa." I said that for a while. And then I started saying, "Step on the magic star and you can see Cher." And people got excited. So I said, "Step on the magic star and you can see Mike Tyson." Some people in the other line, the line to sit on Santa's lap, got excited and cut through the gate so that they could stand on my magic star. Then they got angry when they looked through the magic window and saw Santa rather than Cher or Mike Tyson. But what did they honestly expect? Is Cher so hard up for money that she would agree to stand behind a two-way mirror at Macy's? The angry people must have said something to management, because I was taken off the magic star and sent to Elf Island, which is really boring, as all you do is stand around and act merry. This morning I worked as an exit elf, telling people in a loud voice, "This way out of Santa Land." A woman was standing at one of the cash registers, paying for her pictures while her son lay beneath her, kicking and heaving, having a tantrum. The woman said, "Riley, if you don't start behaving yourself, Santa's not going to bring you any of those toys you asked for." The child said, "He is too going to bring me toys, liar. He already told me." The woman grabbed my arm and said, "You there, elf. Tell Riley here that if he doesn't start behaving immediately, then Santa's going to change his mind and bring him coal for Christmas." I said that Santa changed his policy and no longer traffics in coal. Instead, if you're bad, he comes to your house and steals things. I told Riley that if he didn't behave himself, Santa was going to take away his TV and all his electrical appliances and leave him in the dark. All your appliances, Riley, including the refrigerator. Your food is going to spoil and smell bad. It is going to be so cold and dark where you are. You're going to wish you never even heard the name Santa. The woman got a worried look on her face and said, "All right, that's enough." I said, "He's going to take your car and your furniture and all of your towels and blankets and leave you with nothing." The mother said, "No, that's enough. Really." Two New Jersey families came today to see Santa. Two loud, ugly husbands with two wives and four children between them. The children gathered around Santa and had their pictures taken. When Santa asked the 10-year-old boy what he wanted for Christmas, his father shouted, "A woman! Get him a woman, Santa!" These men were very loud and irritating, constantly laughing and jostling one another. The two women sat on Santa's lap and had their pictures taken, and each asked Santa for a KitchenAid brand dishwasher and a decent winter coat. Then the husband sat on Santa's lap, and when asked what he wanted for Christmas, one of the men yelled, "I want a broad with big jugs!" The man's small-breasted wife crossed her arms over her chest, looked at the floor, and gritted her teeth. The man's son tried to laugh. Hi. Hello. How you doing tonight? What are you up to tonight? What are you drinking? I think I'll have whatever you're having. I could use a change. My roommate Rusty gave me these lines. I don't have any idea what to say to people in clubs and bars. I freeze up and wither away, but Rusty tells me that these lines work. "Hi there. I was just standing across the room and couldn't help but notice that your glass is empty. Can I buy you a drink? I think I'll have whatever you're having." This evening I was a maze elf. Nothing is more boring than being a maze elf. Other maze elves address children and ask, "What do you want for Christmas?" But really, why should a child tell an elf? Santa is who they've come to see, and it seems pathetic for an elf to try to outshine Santa. After children have passed the dancing penguins, they don't care if they ever see another elf as long as they live. The maze is overpopulated with elves. This evening I was stationed in the maze near the candy canes. Children would pass, bored, and I'd say, "How you doing tonight? What are you up to this evening?" "Good. I'll have whatever you're having." Terrific. I've met elves from all walks of life. The recession has hit New York very hard. Most of the other elves are show business people, but several of them had real jobs at advertising agencies and brokerage firms. Bless their hearts. These people never in their wildest dreams figured there was a velvet costume waiting in their future. They're the really bitter elves. Most of the elves are young, high school and college students. They're young and they're cute, and one of the job perks is that I get to see these people in their underpants. The overall cutest elf is a fellow from Queens named Richie. His elf name is Snowball, and he tends to ham it up with the children, sometimes tumbling down the path to Santa's house. I generally gag when elves get that cute, but Snowball is hands down adorable. You want to put him in your pocket. Yesterday, Snowball and I worked as Santa elves, and I got excited when he started saying things like, "I'd follow you to Santa's house any day, Crumpet." It made me dizzy, this flirtation. By mid-afternoon, I was running into walls. By late afternoon, Snowball had cooled down. By the end of our shift, we were in the bathroom, changing our clothes, and all of a sudden, we were surrounded by five Santas and three other elves, All of them were guys that Snowball had been flirting with. Snowball just leads elves on. Elves and Santas. Later on, we were in the elevator, and I heard him say to his friend, "I don't know what these guys all want with me. It gives me the creeps the way they stare." Snowball is playing a dangerous game. It's one thing to get a child fired up, but you really don't want to be working under a jilted Santa.
We're featuring David Sedaris' Santaland Diaries, an expanded version of a reading originally broadcast on NPR's Morning Edition. We'll have more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to David Sedaris' Santaland Diaries about his adventures working as an elf in Macy's Santaland.
Out of all the Santas, two are black, and both are so light-skinned that with the beard and makeup, you'd never know they weren't white. Yesterday, a black woman got upset after having requested a Santa of color. She was sent to Will. "He's not black," the woman said. We assured the woman that yes, he was black, and the woman said, "Well, he isn't black enough." Will is a difficult Santa, moody and unpredictable. He spends a lot of time staring off into space. When a boss tells Will that we need to speed things up, Will gets defensive and says, "Listen, I'm playing a role here, do you understand? A dramatic role that takes a great deal of preparation." I was the pointer elf this afternoon when a woman approached me and whispered, "We would like a traditional Santa. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about." I sent her to Will. Last Saturday, Snowball was the pointer, and a woman said, "Last year we had a chocolate Santa. Make sure it doesn't happen again." Snowball sent it to Will. Today, a child told Santa that he wanted his dead father back and a complete set of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Everyone loves those turtles. A child came to Santa this morning, and his mother said, "All right, Jason. All right, tell Santa what you want. Tell him what you want." Jason said, "I want Procter and Gamble to stop animal testing." The mother said, "Procter, Jason, that's Procter and Gamble. And what do they do to animals? Do they torture animals, Jason? Is that what they do?" Jason said, "Yes. They torture." He was maybe 6 years old. Tonight, a man proposed to his girlfriend in Santa House number 5. Santa asked what he wanted for Christmas, and he pulled a ring out of his pocket and said that he wanted this woman to be his wife. The photo elf got choked up and started crying. I got a new haircut and a few people complimented me, but it didn't register. I spend all day lying to people, saying, "You look so pretty," and "Santa can't wait to visit with you. You're all he talks about. It's just not Christmas without you. You're Santa's favorite person in the entire tri-state area." Sometimes I lay it on really thick. "Aren't you the Princess of Rongovia? Santa said that a beautiful princess was coming to visit him. He said she would be wearing a red dress and that she was very pretty but not stuck up or two-faced. That's you, isn't it?" I lay it on in the parents' mouth the words, "Thank you" and "Good job." To one child I said, "You're a model, aren't you?" The girl was maybe 6 years old and she said, "Yes, I model, but I also act. I just got a second callback for Official Price commercial." The girl's mother said, "You may recognize Caitlin from the My First Sony campaign. She's pictured on the box." I said, "Yes, of course." All I do is lie, and that has made me immune to compliments. This afternoon I was stuck being photo-elf with Santa. I don't know his real name, no one does. During most days there's a slow period when you sit around the house and talk to Santa. And most of them are nice guys and we sit around and laugh. But Santa takes himself a bit too seriously. I asked him where he lives, Brooklyn or Manhattan, and he said, "Why, I live at the North Pole with Mrs. Claus." I asked what he does the rest of the year, and he said, "I make toys for all the children." Santa sits and waves and jingles his bell sash when no one is there. He actually recited The Night Before Christmas, and it was just the two of us in the house. No children, just us. He says, "Oh, little elf, straighten up those mantle toys for Santa." I reminded him that I have a name, Crumpet, and then I straightened up the stuffed animals. "Oh, little elf, bring Santa a throat lozenge." So I brought him a lozenge. Santa has an elaborate little act for the children. He'll talk to them and give a hearty chuckle and ring his bells, and then he asks them to name their favorite Christmas carol. Most of them say Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Santa then asks if they'll sing it for him. The children are shy and don't want to sing out loud, so Santa says, "Oh, little elf, help young Brenda here sing that favorite carol of hers." Then I have to stand there and sing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which I hate. Late in the afternoon, a child said she didn't know what her favorite Christmas carol was. Santa suggested Away in a Manger. The girl agreed to it, but didn't want to sing because she didn't know the words. Santa said, "Oh, little elf, come sing Away in the Manger for us." It didn't seem fair that I should have to solo, so I told Santa that I didn't know the words. Santa said, "Of course you know the words. Come now, sing." So I sang it the way Billie Holiday might have sang if she'd put out a Christmas album. "Away in a manger, no crib for a bed. The little Lord Jesus laid down his sweet head." Santa did not allow me to finish. This evening I was sent to be a photo elf in house number 2. The camera is hidden in the fireplace and I take the picture by pressing a button on the end of a cord. Most elves will hold up a stuffed animal over their fireplace and say, "Look at my little animal friend," and smile. Oftentimes a parent will settle the child on Santa's lap and then start grooming. I've seen mothers pull cans of hairspray from their pocketbooks and spray the child's hair as if Santa were a false prop made out of cement. Hairspray shoots into Santa's eyes and he winces in pain. Once a child starts crying, it's all over. The parents had planned to send these pictures as cards or store them away until the child is grown and can lie, claiming to remember the experience. Tonight I saw a woman slap and shake her crying child. She yelled, "Rachel, get on that man's lap and smile or I'll give you something to cry about." Then she sat Rachel on Santa's lap and I took the picture, which supposedly means, on paper, that everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be, that everything is snowy and wonderful. It's not about the child or Santa or Christmas or anything, but the parents' idea of a world they cannot make work for them.
David Sedaris reading his Santa Land diaries. They're published in his book Barrel Fever, a collection of essays and stories. Santa Land Diaries was produced for radio by NPR's Ira Glass. David Sedaris has a new play called One Woman Shoe. It opens January 19th at La Mama in Manhattan. It's the story of a welfare program which requires all women on welfare to do a one-woman show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Booker T and the MGs recorded this version of White Christmas, a catchy interpretation of an old chestnut. Well, brace yourself. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has some Christmas music for us that's beyond redemption. Don't worry, we've also got some of the great Christmas songs, too, including Charles Brown in concert, singing his own rhythm and blues song, Merry Christmas, Baby. And composers Martin and Blaine tell us the story behind their song, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Also, Stephen Schiff reviews Robert Altman's new film, Ready to Wear. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The United Nations says all parties in Bosnia have agreed to a ceasefire. It's to take effect tomorrow at noon local time. The announcement was made by the UN's representative to Bosnia, Yasushi Akashi. He's just finished 2 days of shuttle diplomacy between the Bosnian government and Bosnian Serbs. He was able to make sure the peace deal first worked out by former President Jimmy Carter took hold. 2 Israeli guerrillas were killed today. Another 7 were hurt when Hezbollah guerrillas attacked their positions in southern Lebanon. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
Israel Radio confirmed the deaths of the 2 soldiers in a series of attacks by Hezbollah guerrillas on Israeli positions on the northern edge of what Israel calls its security zone in southern Lebanon. In response, Israeli airplanes and helicopters strafed suspected guerrilla positions. One helicopter hit a Lebanese police jeep with a guided missile, killing 2 officers. Hezbollah said the attacks were in revenge for a car bomb in Beirut earlier this week, which killed 4 people, including a Hezbollah commander. The Lebanese blame Israel for that bomb. Israel has threatened to take action against Hezbollah following an escalation of fighting in southern Lebanon. 5 Israeli soldiers have died this month in fighting which gets little attention, but which goes on daily. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
A U.S. military spokesman in South Korea says there haven't been any meetings today with the North on the release of Army pilot Bobby Hall. U.S. officials are still hoping the North Koreans will release Hall by Christmas. The United States says Hall and his crewmate, David Heilman, mistakenly flew into North Korea last Saturday. The North says it shot down their helicopter. Heilman died. His body has been turned over to American officials, and Hall is supposed to be freed soon, but it's not clear when. Kenyan President Daniel Arap Moi has threatened to ban the country's leading newspaper, The Nation. He says the paper is undermining Kenya's security. Moi says the paper's reports are promoting tribalism. The BBC's Jane Stanley reports from Nairobi.
President Moi launched his attack on The Nation at a rally in Baringo in the Rift Valley. He accused the paper of fanning the flames of tribalism and said his government could not allow the security of Kenyans to be undermined by any group of people or institution. The president warned that no media organization should consider itself too big to be banned, let alone one which was foreign-owned. The main shareholder in The Nation is the Aga Khan, the spiritual leader of Ismaili Muslims. President Moi said Kenyans who worked for the newspaper stood to lose the most from their actions if chaos broke out in the country. President Moi's comments seem to suggest a stronger line is being taken with the Kenyan media, as does a statement earlier this week that the ban on private radio stations will continue.
Jane Stanley reporting for the BBC. This is NPR. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow gained more than 18 points to end at 3,833. Government workers in Orange County, California, could be facing layoffs. The municipality, which lost an estimated $2 billion in risky investments, is looking for ways to cut 20% of its budget over the next 6 months. Kitty Feldy of member station KCRW prepared this report.
The layoffs won't come until January, but as many as 1,000 county workers could be looking for new jobs after the first of the year. Other cuts will come in the public defender's office, larger caseloads to cut down on the number of outside attorneys hired. Health care and social services will also be trimmed, and salary cuts will be combined with partial payments for sick days and vacation days. Meanwhile, Moody's Investor Service had some good news for other municipalities worried about their investment strategies. Of the 1,400 cities and counties surveyed, not one was engaged in the investment strategies, quote, based on the type and magnitude of leveraging used by Orange County. One word of caution, however, another investment advisory group has warned that four other California counties and two counties in Florida have, quote, a substantial degree of risk in their investments. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
Denver's new troubled airport is a little closer to opening. Engineers say the facility's faulty automated baggage system is now ready to go. The $62 million backup baggage system was able to move 42 bags a minute yesterday in a trial run. The main system is still undergoing a $35 million fix. The government says rising interest rates and falling incomes didn't stop Americans from spending more last month. The Commerce Department says consumer spending rose 0.6% in November, but personal income slipped by 0.1%. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Let's face it, in addition to all the good cheer and goodwill the holiday season brings, there's also a lot of schlock music. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has selected some of his favorite awful Christmas music.
You know, I finally figured out what makes the record industry flood us with Christmas songs each year. The answer is Gene Autry, right, the cowboy? There he was, fading as a singing cowboy movie star, when he wrote Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, thereby assuring his fortune for the rest of his life. So every year, there must be hundreds of hopefuls who remember that and give it a shot on their own. I wish they'd give up. Really, the vast majority of pop Christmas music is enough to make me think about turning into a Hindu. Well, maybe not. There's lots of terrible Indian pop music, too. But you know what I mean. You don't? Okay, you asked for it.
Mamacita. Mamacita, oh, where is Santa Claus? I look for him because it's Christmas Eve. I know that I should be the sleeping, but maybe he's not far away. So out of the window I'm peeping, hoping to see him in his sleigh.
There it was, 1958, and I was an innocent 10-year-old who just discovered rock and roll. I had the radio on constantly, and just as constantly, I was forced to endure little Augie Rios singing Donde Está Santa Claus. The history of U.S. Central American relations is one of us interfering with them. I've always considered Augie Rios to be an act of naked aggression going the other way. But he was only the worst of a bad lot.
Bushels of fun. Now the jingle hop has begun. Jingle bell,
there was Bobby Helms with Jingle Bell Rock, the same man who gave us My Special Angel. But My Special Angel only charted once. I had to endure Jingle Bell Rock in 1957, 58, 60, 61, and 62. Strangely enough, there doesn't seem to have been a big Christmas hit in 59, although you can count on the radios having played the Chipmunk song and the ever-dreadful Harry Simeon Chorale's Little Drummer Boy. Maybe the idea was to get you to go to church where the music would have to be better. Of course, back then, I was ignorant of the fact that there was some actual cool Christmas music. Even though it was, at that time, the best-selling rhythm and blues single ever, Charles Brown's Merry Christmas Baby never came on New York's top 40 stations. Nor did some of the more irreverent stuff, like the Youngsters' only known record.
Christmas in jail, Christmas in jail, had a little too much to drink. Ain't got no bail, ain't got no bail, and I'm spending New Year's Eve in the clink. I was in the wrong lane, feeling no pain, souped my car to 75, ran right into, you can guess who, and they say I'm lucky. Be alive.
Merry Christmas, Happy New Year.
They're singing down the street while everybody's having Christmas turkey. They give me bread and water to eat. Christmas in
Over the years, some of my friends have done some fairly intensive Christmas research and have come up with some amazing records. Brian Cullman, for instance, has put out an hour-long tape every year for almost a decade with stuff that ranges from the most saccharine sentimentality to Zulu choirs from South Africa. So yes, there is good Christmas popular music out there as those things go. But probably the best thing about Christmas music is that after Christmas Day, you don't have to listen to it again for, oh, at least 10.5 months. And having said that, I'd like to leave you with a bit of my favorite Christmas record, from the Temptations' otherwise undistinguished album, Give Love at Christmas. I'm sure you'll recognize it.
As I sit around by the fireplace, watching the gleaming tree, if I had one wish in this world,
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. We first broadcast his Bad Christmas Music piece in 1990. We have some great Christmas music for you after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Don't you swing them jingles, son?
I agree with rock historian Ed Ward that some pretty awful music has been written in the name of Christmas. But Ed Ward has Christmas music he really likes, and so do I. In fact, some of it was recorded right here on Fresh Air, and I want to replay some of it for you. To start, we have a concert recording of one of the songs Ed described as cool Christmas music, a record that never got airplay on New York Top 40 stations in the 60s, even though it was the best-selling rhythm and blues single of its time. The song is Merry Christmas Baby, and the composer is Charles Brown. Brown had 9 top 10 R&B singles between 1946 and 52. A few years ago, he started a successful comeback. He now records for Rounder Records and has a new album called Charles Brown's Cool Christmas. This is from a concert Charles Brown performed for us in June of 1989. And even though Christmas was far away, I asked him to perform the Christmas song so many people know him for.
They know me for that. No care where I go, whatever time of year, Terry. Christmas, baby, you sure did treat me nice. Merry Christmas, baby, sure did treat me nice. Gave me a diamond ring for Christmas. Now I'm living in paradise.
I'm feeling mighty fine. Got good music on my stereo. Feeling mighty fine. Got good music on my radio. Well, I wanna kiss you, baby, while you're standing beneath the mistletoe. Satan ain't coming down the chimney yet, too.
Charles Brown from a 1989 Fresh Air concert. Back in 1988, we invited Susanna McCorkle to perform a Christmas concert. McCorkle records for the Concord Jazz label, tours around the country, and performs at the top cabaret rooms in New York. On her Fresh Air Christmas concert, she sang a melancholy Christmas song.
Christmas, you can count on me. Please have snow.
Susanna McCorkle from her 1988 Fresh Air Christmas concert. Lee Musiker accompanied her at the piano with Dean Johnson on bass. Her latest album is called From Broadway to Bebop. A lot of jazz musicians say that the Christmas song with the most interesting chord changes is Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. The song was written for the movie musical Meet Me in St. Louis. A Broadway adaptation premiered in late 1989, and for the occasion we invited Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine, who wrote the songs for the original musical and the revival. I asked them to tell the story of how they wrote Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas for Judy Garland.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. Next year Yuletide gay. Next year all our troubles will be miles away. Once again.
Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you for having us.
One of the things I really love about Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas is that, well, so many of the Christmas songs have these, like, cheerful platitudes, and this is such a kind of brooding song about loss in a minor key. Tell me the story behind writing the song.
Well, it began with the melody. I found a little madrigal-like tune that I liked but couldn't make work. So I played with it for 2 or 3 days, and then I threw it in the wastebasket and forgot about it. But Ralph, bless his heart, tell her how you reacted.
I remembered that little melody, and it kept haunting me. And I came into the room one day, and I said, Hugh, what did you do with that little melody that you were fooling around with at the piano, that was like a madrigal? He says, I threw it in the wastebasket. I said, oh, no. I've got a great idea. You mustn't do that. Let's get it. And so we dug around in the wastebasket, and we found it. Thank the Lord we found it.
Yes. And then we wrote a lyric which nobody liked, especially Judy, because it was extremely sad and tragic. Can you sing it the way it was, Ralph?
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. It may be your last. Next year we will all be living in the past. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Pop that champagne cork. Next year we will all be living in New York.
And we thought that was just dandy because it was a sad scene. But they said, no, it's a sad scene, but we want a sort of an upbeat song, which will make it even sadder if she's smiling through her tears. So then we wrote the one that you know in the movie. And then there was another version, Ralph.
But one day, Frank Sinatra called us and said he wanted to record the song, but he couldn't sing the line about, until then we'll have to muddle through somehow. So he said, give me a happy line and I'll record the song.
It was because of the title of his album, which was A Jolly Christmas. So he wanted us to jolly it up a bit.
And Hugh came up with the line, hang a shining star upon the highest bough. And Sinatra was delighted and recorded the song. In fact, he's recorded it 3 times.
Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine. It's always interesting to hear songwriters performing their own songs. There's a 1956 album of Martin and Blaine doing their own songs. Here's Ralph Blaine singing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas.
When the steeple bells sound their A, they don't play it in tune, but the welkin will ring one day, soon. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. Next year all our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a the Yuletide gay. Next year.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. So, Robert, are you trying to sign a deal with Newt Gingrich's agent?
No, I'm not, but we will have a story today about Newt Gingrich's remarkable book deal. They'd get more than $4 million under it. Also news of the fall of the Mexican peso, of some Republican committee assignments in the U.S. Senate that may seem like very small news inside the Beltway, but actually it might have some much bigger consequences. And we'll have a special report from producer David Isay about the preachers of Times Square. He spent some time with an independent filmmaker who's been filming the men who walk around preaching in the center of Manhattan.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Five years ago, the film world had largely given up on Robert Altman, the director of the 70s films MASH, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and Nashville. In the 90s, his career was revived by The Player and Shortcuts. Altman's new movie is one of the most eagerly awaited of the holiday season. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Ready to Wear.
Robert Altman has made bad movies before, and he's entitled. The power of his best work comes partly from his willingness to leap off artistic cliffs without worrying too much about where he may land. But there's a difference this time, and the difference is hype. When Altman directed Turkeys before, I'm talking about movies like Health, Beyond Therapy, Quintet, O.C. and Stigs, the world hardly took notice. But how can you avoid taking notice of Ready to Wear, with its huge four-page newspaper ads, with its oceans of pre-publicity during last spring's Paris fashion collections, with its screenings at various society benefits, not to mention the little furor that arose at the change of the movie's name, from Prêt-à-Porter, which at least had some pizzazz, to its dull English translation. Even Off the Rack would have sounded more intriguing. Ready to Wear is an attempt to make a Nashville of the fashion world. It has 31 featured characters and a dozen plots, all of them woven around the week of the Paris collections. At the beginning, the organizer of those collections chokes to death on a sandwich, and a murder investigation ensues. But since we know from the start that the murder wasn't really a murder, and that all of the suspects are therefore innocent, the movie has no narrative motor. There's no plot, only a bunch of subplots. One of them features Stephen Ray as a hotshot fashion photographer being wooed by the outlandishly stupid editors of Vogue, Elle, and Harper's Bazaar. The most dignified of the three is Linda Hunt as the editor of Elle, and Altman conspires to strip her of that dignity instantly in scenes like this one between her and Stephen Ray.
You know what I want to talk about, don't you?
I haven't the foggiest, but I love surprises.
And I love your work. I want you to sign with Elle. I'll get you everything you want. I'd stake my job on it.
Would you now?
Yes, I would. And more than that.
What could be more than that, Miss Crumb?
Well, let's see. I would get down on my hands and knees if I thought it would help.
You never know, might help.
I beg your pardon.
The movie seems at once half-baked and overcooked. Half-baked because none of the ideas in it feel thought through, because all the characters are two-dimensional cartoons, and because the jokes are obvious and flat. And overcooked because Altman seems to have arrived in Paris already knowing everything he wanted to say about the fashion world. In other words, he appears to have observed nothing, learned nothing, experienced nothing. The fashion world is superficial. The people in it are shallow. They take themselves too seriously. They battle over trivia. This is biting satire. Ready to Wear is not only unfunny and charmless, it's insulting. You feel as though you'd been invited to a fancy dinner, only to have the chef serve up beans and francs and call it haute cuisine. I say, ignore the hype and save your money. For the price of 4 tickets, you can just about afford a pair of Calvin Klein underwear.
Film critic Stephen Schiff, Merry Christmas from all of us at Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we begin a 4-day series reflecting on religion and faith. We'll hear from Karen Armstrong, author of the bestseller A History of God. Ari Goldman, an Orthodox Jew, tells us about studying Christianity at Harvard Divinity School. And we talk with Sogyal Rinpoche, a Buddhist teacher who was part of the last generation to grow up in a Tibetan monastery. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.